This episode is brought to you by Rock in Rio Lisboa, the sister event to Brazil's iconic music festival Rock in Rio. The Portuguese leg of the event is set to celebrate its 20th anniversary with one of its biggest editions yet, and over 80,000 attendees across its 4 days, of which some of them could be you. Taking place over 2 weekends this June, some of music's biggest names will be taking to the stage in Lisbon. We're talking Ed Sheeran, we're talking Doja Cat, even the Jonas Brothers are getting in on the action. And with each day specially curated by genre, there's literally something for everyone. I went to the town in Rio last year, which is curated by the same people as Rock in Rio, and it was, I'm going to say, one of the wildest festivals I've ever been to. This year's Rock in Rio Lisboa takes place on the 15th, 16th, 22nd and 23rd of June, and tickets can be purchased now via their website, rockinriolisboa.pt. And welcome to Before They Knew Better, the podcast from DIY Magazine. My name is Lisa Wright, and this is my co-host and producer. His name is Giles Bidder.
Hello!
Today we have, well, personally, a very special one. This is the first time that we've had more than one guest on Before They Knew Better. It's the first time that we've had siblings on Before They Knew Better. And it's the first time we've had two of The Cribs, one of my favourite bands, on this podcast. We have Gary and Ryan Jarman joining us from two sides of America. I think it's a very different chat when you get two different sides of the same childhood, you know? Like, they're, you know, the same age bar a few minutes. They've grown up in the same city, they've grown up in the same household, but are obviously two sides of a similar coin. So I think hearing that from the perspective of not only brothers but twins, about growing up in Wakefield, about how boring towns with not much to do can yield the most creativity sometimes, because you've just got to make your own fun. So that was a very enlightening chat with The Cribs, my favourites. I mean, if we're talking about our own childhoods, The Cribs were the first band that I went to go and see in London. Cribs, huge part of my teenage years, so it was an absolute dream to sit down with Ryan and Gary and chat about their own youths. I feel like it's a fitting tribute to Kurt Cobain, as there's been a lot of anniversary chat about his legacy. And we also got a little snippet of the Jarmans' first band. Are we calling it their first band? Their first sort of musical forays. Mm-hmm. Their first recorded things, of which we will also have, I'm going to say, the first ever played public snippet. So for Cribs heads out there, this is pretty cool. Exclusive early youth content. As always, with Before They Knew Better, we have asked Gary and Ryan, alongside this lovely snippet of their early music, to bring in an object and a photo from their youth. So, without further ado, this is Gary and Ryan Jarman of The Cribs on the newest episode of Before They Knew Better with DIY Magazine. This is the first time that we've had two people simultaneously. First time having more than one person at a time on this podcast. First time having siblings or any family members. So I feel like this is a groundbreaking new realms for DIY, and also hopefully a gateway into some lovely memories of early 90s Wakefield. I mean, I guess like mid-80s to early 90s.
I don't know if the 80s will come up that much, though, in this kind of, you know, when it comes to the stuff that we're talking about, that is most based in the 90s, I think.
I would say 1991 is going to be the key year, you know. We have to do it together because, you know, obviously neither of us want to have the dominion over each other's memories of their own childhood, you know what I mean? So it's quite it's very dangerous ground to like let one of us interpret this kind of thing without the other's input.
What was the first thing that you remember? Do you remember anything about 1991 knowing that it was that year.
Robbing a Prince of Thieves will be the first thing that comes into my mind.
I guess we were kind of like, at that point, all I really remember, you know, being into around them was like playing Super Nintendo and stuff. That was 91.
Super Nintendo was 92. So 91 was a bit before that. So it was still kind of like, that was before we hadn't gone to high school yet. We were still at junior school.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
So here's the thing, like here's the defining moments of 91 that I can remember. I was just coming off a massive obsession with Ghost, the Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore movie. That was the most important thing in the world to me in 1990. I had a scrapbook and everything.
A scrapbook?
Yeah, like that is the one thing from my youth that I would have used it for this, actually. It's the one thing that I don't currently own that I really wish that I had. But I think
What were you scrapbooking, as in like your own sort of thoughts and feelings?
Just any like newspaper or magazine clippings on either Ghost the movie or individually Demi Moore, Patrick Swayze and Whoopi Goldberg. It's the one thing that I really wish that I still had, but like it got lost in the move. And then shortly after that, like Rye got really we all really got into Freddy Krueger. So like 91 was like really sort of more, it was pre-music and pre like computer games and pre-adolescence. It was just like, we were just like into like films and stuff.
Yeah, like, I used to do a thing when it was anyone in the family's birthday, I would dress as Freddy Krueger and hand out presents. I don't know why that was like a, I have no idea why that was a tradition in our family, but it became one. And
yeah, it was really good as well. It was like, it wasn't really a birthday unless Rye had done the Freddy Krueger show.
It's one of those things that I feel like a lot of people our age will remember, it that you were really into, you know, scary movies or like adult-based movies when you were like 8 or 9 or something. You know, that's,
yeah, like anything that you weren't really, you know, you weren't really allowed. Essentially a controlled substance by your parents, so it was an illicit thing. So like, yeah, and you could get hold of a horror movie or something, but. But 91 was also the year that Freddie Mercury died, and we were into Queen, but in that sort of universal way that like you're into music as a kid, where it's like you're not necessarily specifically into it, but it's just such a present thing in your life, and you just think that music's this amorphous entity that's just like, you know, Queen were just such a big presence in our life that it's almost like we didn't focus on them specifically until, you know, all the rumors were coming out in the press about Freddie Mercury, and like me and Rye became really defensive about him, like, and like we would like argue with our school friends about it, and like and that was a massively pivotal moment in our lives. Like
I remember like when it all, you know, when there was a lot of coverage towards the end of his life, we were in like full on denial that we was just convinced that he was going to be okay somehow and stuff. And he was
a superhero to us, you know, it's like superhero guy. And like, you know, 1991, school kids, like, you know, the whole AIDS epidemic and the whole like thing surrounding it, it was very much like a period of time when people were quite secretive and weird about all that kind of stuff, and you can imagine how, you know, 10 11 year old school kids like would talk about stuff like that that age. And so me and Rye were just like, you know, we were that was a hill we were prepared to die on. Like, we would like defend, we fell out with so many of our friends over the whole Freddie Mercury thing. So
yeah, it was kind of, I see that as being like a, you know, like a watershed moment as kids, where we really nailed our flag to the mast for something for the first time, you know what I mean?
That's when we committed to music. It was like we realized like that was worth losing friends over, you know. And so it was the first time we like strongly and actively like engaged with music, I suppose.
I think like having the sort of balls at that age to really stand up for this thing that you believe in, even if it's against the grain, like, was that just, do you feel like that was your sort of embedded personalities from even being like younger than that? Like, were you always quite sort of like separate as a two-piece unit from like other kids?
I think that me and Gary, because we like you know, because we were the same age and we were at the same school and stuff, probably were a little more in our own world because there was two of us, you know what I mean? And it's something that I never really I never really acknowledged until like I saw someone recently saying that they went to college with me, but they never got to know me because me and Gary were so insular and we never mixed with, you know, we never would hang out and socialize in the way that everyone else did. But I never realized that. But I think it's probably because, you know, we always had our own things going on and our own obsessions and stuff, and we could indulge in that together. So maybe we were a little bit, a little bit more into it than what I thought that we were.
But we could close ranks really effectively without realizing we were doing it. Like, my mum has stories about, like, she would, like, me and Rye, she would hear us fighting in the other room, and she would come through, like, to, like, you know, sort it out and tell off whoever was the perpetrator. But she said that every time, like we would close ranks and like wouldn't say what had happened, which I, you know, again, that's just an anecdote that I didn't know, but that's something that she mentioned to me just recently. But I think it was the same thing at school. But regarding the Freddie Mercury thing, it wasn't really something that was coming from our convictions at that point. It was more like, or at least not actively, it was just more like it sort of felt a bit sacrilegious to us in some ways, you know, like we just kind of couldn't believe that somebody would, like, that people would take shots at someone like that. It just didn't seem right.
I feel like before we move on, I do really just want to go back to the ghost thing very quickly, because like all of the Freddie Mercury, you know, obviously pop icon. When you're young, you can see him all over the telly and the radio, and he's like a superstar. Freddy Krueger is cool because it's like scary and Halloween. Patrick Swayze and Ghost, maybe a little bit more unlikely an obsession for a 10-year-old.
It was the first thing that. The first thing I can remember, like, being obsessed with, I saw it just recently, like, like on Valentine's Day, I think it might have, on Valentine's Day, it was back in the theaters in Portland. I went to see it. I actually cried. It's so, like, I can't, well, it was really, really embarrassing. Like, I didn't mean to. I was trying to talk to my wife. I just couldn't do it. And it's like, I don't know where it comes from. It just has some sort of effect on me, does that film? But mainly, I think the effect is because it reminds me of, like, just how mixed up I felt at that age, you know? Like, it was like... I definitely had a big crush on Demi Moore, which is funny because she's so androgynous in that film. And, like, that was confusing as a 10-year-old in some ways, and like, and also the movie's so romantic, and like, and also kind of, and it's, well, it's sad and touching, and like, you at the age that I was, it was like, I don't know, it just, I really sort of, I had very like complex feelings towards,
I remember that around that time we used to go to a swimming baths in Wakefield, which is like it was like, you know, like your classic like Victorian style swimming, like public baths. The only music that they ever seemed to play in there was Unchained Melody from Ghost, you know, it was popular at the time, and Sacrifice by Elton John. So it was a very you know, like the swimming experience was
very emotional.
Emotionally charged. Yeah.
Did you speak to each other about your feelings when you were kids? You know, if you were confused or felt, I don't know. You know, you were feeling feelings for the first time. Did you speak to each other about it much?
I'd say that it was very much. We both knew exactly what the other person, like what the motivation for the other person's interests were, and we acknowledged and respected that. Didn't always speak explicitly about it, but it was always known. But only when Ross was involved would it become teasing. So if Ross was involved, Rye and Ross would tease me about Ghost, and likewise for like whatever their interests were. Whereas he definitely knew what it was about and would wouldn't mess with me.
Yeah, but the teasing was also part of it anyway, because you would love that being teased about it. You know what I mean? It's like that is part of it makes you giddy and excited that people have
recognized that. Yeah. Like it was validating. It became part of your personality that like, oh, this is Gary. He's that kid who really likes Demi Moore or whatever. And you'd be like, yeah, all right, cool. And then, which was better than like my prior association, which I was the kid who fancied Lisa Simpson at school. So like that was, that was really complicated also.
What a strong list of early crushes to have rattled through in the pre-adolescence.
It was really complex feelings, you know what I mean? It's like messed up time.
Yeah, it was the 90s, man. Everything was different then. What you're saying there about sort of knowing what the other one was thinking anyway, it's obviously such a cliche with the twin thing, but also something that I think no one else, it's like fascinating from someone who doesn't have that sibling relationship, like the idea of having someone that's like that close to you in like age, but life experience has just gone through the same things. Like, do you think, I mean, I guess, like, was that something that you'd play up to when you were younger? Like, did you like being half of like this little sort of unit?
Well, the thing is, so it's like, I remember at school people would do stuff like, oh, well, if I kick you, will the other one feel it? You know, like ridiculous stuff like that. And it's not, it doesn't, we don't know anything.
They don't.
Yeah, no, but we don't know any different. We don't know what it's like to not be part of a twin. But I think because of the like growing up together and the life experience together, and also just the susceptibility to the same things, because of how closely we are, genetically. Yeah, it just means that you just like there is just an understanding that you build up over years and years and years of just always being together. So I don't think it's any more mystical than that, really. But I don't remember us ever playing up to it. I mean, people obviously like refer to you all the time as a singular, really. You know what I mean? We were always like the Germans or twinnies or whatever. You know what I mean? You're not necessarily seen as much of an individual, but I was never that bothered about it. I think Gary didn't like it, but I just never even thought, I just didn't think about it. I just didn't think about it.
I didn't care. I mean, the one thing that I would say is that like it was really useful. We didn't think about it like before adolescence, but when you get into your teenage years, it became like a really useful and valuable thing, and you started to recognize it, because from a very, very young age, as in like, as soon as you start to like be able to like form memories, you learn empathy, because obviously it's not just you that's there, it's you and somebody else. Mm-hmm. Your other half, essentially. And so your parents try and teach you that empathy, like they want you to like not squabble and not fall out and understand each other's feelings. But there's also like an unspoken, like you don't need to be taught it, you can't you can't be happy if the other person's not happy because you're together all the time. So you learn very young, and it's like an And so when you become a teenager, you're actually pretty well-rounded because you're empathetic to other people, but also you have somebody else and you're sensitive towards other people too. I mean, I don't know if, you know, I would have been anyway, but like I chalk it up to the fact that like I had to take other people, another person's feelings into account, like simultaneously with my own growing up. But also like when you're a teenager, you've got somebody else there who understands what you're dealing with. And me and Ryan had like classic turbulent, like proper teen angst, like very, you know, very turbulent adolescent, which was like, but we discovered everything and did everything together. And it's like, that was, you know, that those were, I can't imagine having dealt with that on my own in a lot of ways, because it was...
Well, to be fair, though, I always experienced and discovered things a little bit earlier than Gaz, and then would come up and be like, Gaz, you've got to check this out. Like, you won't believe what I was doing earlier on.
That's excellent. I think so many people who are really into their music, it's because of a sibling, or, you know, specifically like an older sibling.
Yeah, and like, you know, that was some, like getting into bands together was really, it was a really amazing time, because we could, like, we sort of fed each other's obsession in some ways, you know, because like, for example, like we've said it a bunch of times, but we never had much money growing up. And so what we would do to get CDs, because CDs were expensive. So what we'd do to get to CDs is we would just, we got £1.50 a day dinner money, which between me and Rai, that's £3 a day. So if we didn't eat all week at school, 3 times 5 is 15, which is the price of a CD. So if me and Rai didn't eat lunch during the school week, we could get a CD on the weekend. And that's how we used to fund our, you know, that's how we bought Incesticide by Nirvana. It's how we got in fact, I think it's how we got all of the Nirvana records except for Nevermind, which we got for Christmas. But then
we learned that there was a way of getting a 5-finger discount as well to get CDs. So we started eating again. It was a really great discount.
I was going to say, did your mum ever notice that both of her sons were getting progressively smaller, but also like suddenly had just like a rack of CDs?
Yes, I got glandular fever, so I had a perfect. I got glandular fever, so I had a perfect cover for it. So I was really ill for a while.
There we go. That's a lesson for all of the kids watching now.
I think if they did know that, they just respected it, because it was like, it was pretty enterprising, you know. It's just like, oh, these guys are so passionate about this that they're prepared to, like, how they're gonna do it. Like, they didn't care whether we were like eating a hot dog and a hamburger every day at school for like school lunch, you know. So it was they probably respected it, but that was our only way of funding CDs when it wasn't our birthday or Christmas. So.
But were your parents quite musically inclined? Like, did you grow up in quite a music household?
My mum played music, you know, on a informal level. She wrote a really great song, actually. Like, and she had a guitar and stuff. Like, and she really encouraged us when we started playing violin. I mean, my mum and dad are like, they were interested in music, but I wouldn't, it's not like we came from, we're not like the Von Trapps, you know what I mean? It's not like those kind of things.
My mum had been in a band, in like a local band in the 70s, like a short-lived kind of local band, but it was more like a social kind of just fun kind of thing, you know.
But my mum really liked the fact that me and Ray were you know, artistically inclined rather than anything else, because like we never really, me and Ray could never really, we tried certain things, like we, you know, we tried playing football like for like one season for Ossett Trinitarians, which we just didn't have the competitive urge. We just wouldn't get stuck in. And did karate at one point, like, which my mum was really scared when I was doing karate, but like, actually, we're pretty decent at that.
classic anecdote from the football, when we started doing football, is the only match we ever played, we got subbed on and then subbed straight back off, you know what I mean? So that it was short. That's how short-lived it was. I think we were on the field for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, my dad was really pissed off because, like, at the end of the game, like, all the kids got donuts, but they didn't give me and Rye donuts. So, like, my dad was pissed off, and that was the end of us playing for Ossett Trinitarians. my mum was happy we weren't doing that sort of thing, I think. You know, we played in, like, orchestras and stuff, and I think she was much more comfortable, like, with us, like, you know, having to wear, like, suits and go play orchestral music than wearing a, you know, a gi and taking part in karate tournaments. So,
yeah, I think objectively, probably, although you can probably do quite a bit of harm with a violin bow if you put your mind to it, I'd imagine.
Yeah, but I mean, it was more like, I think in some ways that was more damaging for me and Rye, like, you know, because it was like, it was such a strict and like refined approach to music. You didn't really get any slack or any, it was strict. Like, if you weren't pulling your weight, you'd be sort of like, It was quite shaming at times in the orchestra. And like, and not, the other thing was, me and Rye were quite qualified at the time. We were grade 8 violinists. We never got moved off the back desk of the violin 2 section because they didn't like our appearance, because we were grungers. We had long hair and we were scruffy, and they just would not move us ahead on the...
They even said something like, oh, you know, you'll never be in the on the front desk, like, you know, looking this way. We were actually told something like that at one point.
Yeah.
We were just like, well, whatever, you know. But
to be fair, we were showing up stoned quite often. Yeah,
but it was saying that it was damaging playing classical music, but in some ways it was great, because you would get out, like, there was 2 weeks a year, and it was in summer, that you would have to take 2 weeks off school because they wanted you to do like this intensive rehearsal thing to get ready for for this classical concert. And me and Gary were so different to everyone that was there, as you can imagine. And so we would have 2 weeks off school to go do this thing. But we would go up to, there was a castle nearby, and we'd go up there and we'd get stoned every afternoon. And then playing in the orchestra in the afternoon session was so intense. You know, it was like it was super intense, but it was extreme.
It's like an extreme sport. The music is really, really loud and like really heavy, like as heavy as you can imagine. And you're looking at the conductor, which you have to do like the whole time. And he looks fucking terrifying, you know, because it's like he's so like locked in, and you're just like, and you're looking at these like a million blobs on the page, on the manuscript, and you're like, how do I even know what's going on here? Like, but our friend, like, was a really great cellist, and he was the front desk for the cellos. He's like a really esteemed cellist in Europe now, which is funny. But he used to get stoned with us, and we'd keep making eye, me and Ryan be making eye contact with him the whole time through, just like this, yeah, like, you know, just, you know, like that kind
all
of
in work,
all it's solidarity, yeah. Just like, man, are you hanging on here? And be like, barely.
Beautiful memories. So was that sort of at the same time that you were getting into Nirvana, getting into like punk and grunge, and maybe starting to think about like the early seeds of first bands?
Yeah, I'd say it's around the same time, and we were actually missing a little bit of a period here. So we started playing violin when we were 6, so we were in various orchestras, you know, growing up. That age that we're talking about, when we would, you know, like get high and stuff, that we were probably around 14, 15 at that point. So that was when after we got into bands and the van stuff. But before that, We had the Bee Gees phase, which we've got to get into, you know what I mean? So
yes. So the song that you have chosen is, and also when you say Bee Gees phase, like the song that you've chosen is not even a single, I don't think. It was like a Bee Gees deep cut off like one of their less successful albums. So
of course it has to be that, you know, like it was never gonna be you know, Saturday Night Fever or whatever their other songs were, is it? But this is what I was going to get into when we were talking about like not having all the siblings and stuff. We didn't really have anyone who turned us on to music, you know what I mean? Like, it, because we were both the same age, it's not like you had someone who was like you know, influencing you or feeding you good ideas for music. My uncle when we were kids turned us on to Queen, but I'm pretty sure I'm convinced that every family in the UK has a member of the family that makes it their duty to turn all the younger generation onto Queen, you know what I mean? So I don't think that's you know, unique to us. I just think that's just every family's got one, you know. But but after that, like, we didn't really have anyone who was turning us on to music, but we always liked music. We'd spent a lot of time listening to Queen and you know, got used to that whole got used to listening to music in our bedroom as being a pastime. But then there was a phase where
Freddie died,
we didn't really know what we were going to listen to. And then the Bee Gees came back with one of their less esteemed albums in the 90s, and we saw them on TV on
Top of the Pops.
No, it wasn't Top of the Pops.
Oh, Talking Telephone Numbers. They were on Talking Telephone Numbers.
They were on Cilla Black, Surprise, Surprise. And they came out and they played this song. And we really liked this song. No, not the song that you're about to play. They played the single from that album called For Whom the Bell Tolls, and we really liked it. And then we saved up and bought the album and just got obsessed with that. I remember asking my mum, giving her the money and asking her when she went shopping that week to buy us a Bee Gees album. And she was really confused as to why we wanted a Bee Gees album. She quizzed us on it, you know, like, why?
But if anything, like, it's funny because everyone always thinks like, oh, when you get into punk rock or like metal or whatever, or it's, you know, that's when your parents start worrying about you and all this stuff. And it's like, I think our parents were more worried about me and Rye when like we were like 12 or 13 and we're like listening to the Bee Gees like really loud in our bedroom and like painting like D&D models, you know, like, and they were just like, man, you kids have got to get out. Like, you should be out there doing teenager stuff. Like, instead you're like at home listening to like, you know, like a bunch of like 50 something year old guys that like singing love songs and you painting D&D models and you don't even play D&D. Like, what is going on? Very brief period for me and I. We were just looking for something after Freddie died. So you just go and live in that fantasy realm for like a few months, you know? And it was pure escapism. It's hard to explain to people now just how, before the internet, how isolated you would feel and how little you would have to do. Like we went through a phase like briefly of like being into basketball, which was like, you know, very brief phase of being into basketball, very brief phase of being into Warhammer. And then we found the Bee Gees and that became the big thing.
The Gladiators came and did a signing at All Sports in Wakefield, queued up all there to see them. And then we went to go see them at Wembley. Oh, no, one of the TV tapings because it was free. On the day that we went to go see them in Wembley, we were allowed the day off school. No, the afternoon off school. My mum was never going to let us have the full day off. So they gave us the afternoon off school. And we came home, had spaghetti hoops and hot dogs in smoky bacon sauce and a bottle of Tab Clear. Great day.
What a day.
Forever ingrained in your memory.
Yeah. What Tab Clear, though, you know, Tab Clear had just come out at that point.
It was Tab Clear?
You don't know what Tab Clear is?
Tab Clear. It was only available in the UK during the year of 1992. And it's since come out. The read about it. The story of Tab Clear is fascinating. We used to really love it as kids because it was 23p, so we could afford it.
Let's explain that it was a clear cola, so it tasted like it was supposed to taste like Coke. I mean, it was made by Coke, but it was looked like lemonade.
So what it was like Crystal Pepsi was like massively popular, and it was destroying Coke in the market share. And so Coke created Tab Clear because Tab was an inferior sort of diet brand from the 70s. So they created Tab Clear to like insinuate that like clear colas are somehow like not as good as regular cola. So it was a pure kamikaze effort. And it took down Crystal Pepsi, which is an amazing story.
Well, and then,
very short version of it, but we just loved it. It was 23p and you could afford it when you were on a budget of saving your dinner money for records. So it was
We used to talk about it so much on social media and talk about Crystal Pepsi that the last time we played in the States, someone that worked at Pepsi brought us a crate of Crystal Pepsi. Two crates. I think you've got them in your basement, right?
Oh, got it, yeah.
Yeah, we've talked enough about this stuff, I think. But suffice to say, we tend to get pretty obsessive about stuff, like with us being twins.
Yeah, I'm starting to get this vibe. It was a short bursts of intense obsession. But the Bee Gees, I mean, like, what? What was it that sort of piqued your 10-year-old mourning for Freddie brain? Because like very different Queen, very, very different artists objectively.
It was just that when we saw them on Surprise Surprise, it's just that the single from that album is just really good, like really good pop melody, you know what I mean? And like Queen always had good pop melodies, and when you the age that we were, that's kind of what you're listening for is the melody. You know what I mean? That sticks with you.
But the thing is, Ryan, and I thought you were going to say this, is like for me and Ryan, the ultimate is always, if the song is touching, we were in it. And the song they played was really touching. And we were just like, but this is the thing, like going back to the Ghost scrapbook and stuff, we both went away. We'd both been completely floored by this song, but neither of us said anything about it. And then eventually we started like teasing each other, like, you really like that Bee Gees song, I can tell you really like that Bee Gees song. And they're like, yeah, that's your favorite song, your favorite band's the Bee Gees and all this. And eventually it was just like, that was just our way of breaking the ice. We both really liked it, but we were too embarrassed to tell each other. And then it was like, yeah, all right, I admit it, Bee Gees are my favorite band, yeah, I love that song, yeah. The whole album, Sizes and Everything, released in 1993. Amazing, amazing album. And looking back, it was as influential on us as what Nirvana were, and as you know, our big influences like Nirvana and Ramones and stuff like that. It's like that Bee Gees album was as influential as that because it came at such a important time. I listen back to it now. I listened to it yesterday, and it's like I still know all the lyrics. And it's, I think it informed our idea of melody, our idea of harmony. There's a lot of harmony on there.
Mm-hmm.
Like all the counter melodies, there's lots of like keyboard counter melodies and stuff.
Song like, structure as well. I think that, like, the, you know, yeah.
It's like you wouldn't necessarily, like, the people were always like, oh, the Cribs, because like, you know, we always got tagged as being like a sort of chaotic punk band, but people would always mention like, you know, the big choruses or the pop melodies, which seemed a little bit idiosyncratic when compared to like, you know, like other punk bands. And it was like, but it's because like that, I think that record had set like a benchmark for us as to like, not that we could acknowledge that, but just like subliminally a benchmark of like what a good melody is. And like it's a really, really high bar. But I listened to the album and it's like I can hear so many things that like we subconsciously like via osmosis like sort of have implemented in what we do. I mean, aesthetically, it's not really anything like us, but like from a songwriting and song constructing point of view, there's like,
yeah,
it had a big impact on us.
Were these things, you know, you were saying before about like fighting Freddie's corner at school, would you be vocal about like your love of the Bee Gees? Because I would imagine that even if between the two of you, you were digging it in the Jarman household, that maybe that would be less embraced by your peers.
We were vocal about it, and it's one of those things that, like, yeah, at first is like a weird thing, but we actually ended up turning a few more people onto it at school. It was
nice.
Only like a couple of people, but
mainly nerds. A couple of nerds got into it, and then I remember like one of the cool kids was like, "These guys' favorite bands are fucking Beatles or something." Like that's what he said, as if being into the Beatles is bad. But like you know, at that age, it's just like it was just old people music as far as they.
Did you ever get to see them together?
No, we didn't. Like, and I would have loved to have done, but we'd expended our, live gig credit by going to see the Gladiators that year, and there's no way I was going to be able to get
a gig. We didn't get to many gigs at all, like, when we were kids, you know what I mean? Like, no, like, we never went to any, like, the first shows that we started going to were just, like, local punk rock shows in around Wakefield. Like, that's when we started like going to gigs. We never got the chance to go to any like big concerts or whatever as when we were really young. We were supposed to go to the Freddie Mercury tribute concert that was at Wembley Stadium. That was supposed to be our first show, but it sold out too quickly. So
The photo that you brought in when you are very little is you two in the back of a car. Maybe you would be on the back of a car going to Gladiators or similar. Or what sort of, why did you pick this photo? I mean, A, I think like it's so, you can so tell these two kids with like very discernibly different but similar personalities, even in that photo. It's quite, I thought it was quite sweet looking at it, and like you can kind of immediately tell who's who.
Well, it's actually, it's not, I mean, that photo's actually from when we're about, you were a bit older. It must be
1994 is that photo. You can tell because Rai's wearing the Nirvana Nevermind t-shirt. If you look at it, he's wearing a Nevermind t-shirt, and he wore that t-shirt like the year that Kurt Cobain died in 1994, and like that year was like for us, it was a year spent in mourning essentially. And like, you know, we both wore like Nirvana shirts like pretty much all year. That was like, I mean, that was,
you know, 14 is a time when, you know, like, you know, hormones are kicking in, and you start to, you know, generally notice personality changes anyway. But you can see in that photo that, like, you know, that we definitely don't look like wide-eyed kids anymore. There's a sullenness about the whole thing, you know what I mean? So it's definitely 94.
Well, you're that age where you still have to hang out with your parents and your family a lot because you're dependent on them, but you're sort of trying to pull away from them. So you sort of, you know, that photo was taken by my granddad, I think. It looks like it's in my granddad's car. But we're not smiling for the photo because we're all, you know, we're 13 at that point, and we're like, oh, you know, you're trying to sort of set yourself apart. So you're not like a kid smiling on a photo. You're embarrassed by that. So you're like camera shy and just don't want to. And I think Kurt Cobain dying did kind of change our personality a lot in that year. Cause like at 13 years old, something as sort of like, it really disillusioned us. Like we just kind of couldn't believe that was something that happened. And like, I'll say like Rise wearing the Nevermind t-shirt, that was something that was like, you know, almost like our like little vigil in Wakefield, you know, keeping the flame alive. But there's a bunch of kids in Wakefield who felt the same way, like, because by 94 we'd started making friends with kids who were into punk rock, like, you know, and like Wakefield had it, you know, as most small towns do, that the kids who are into like, you know, alternative culture really bond together, and there's no delineation between whether you like punk or grunge or metal or goth music. They were all just the same. Like, you know, you used to get, like, you know, abused and take shit from, like, the straight people. So you all bonded together as misfits. And, like, Kurt Dying was like all those kids were just really affected by it. It's a big thing to go through at that age, in those formative years, you know.
Yeah, there was such a darkness to that one, though, which made, you know, when we main thing, there was such a heaviness and darkness to it. And, like, the first that I remember hearing about it was because everyone used to get up and watch, like, The Big Breakfast or whatever. You used to watch, like, breakfast TV. We never got up in time. We'd always get up and just run for the bus, you know what I mean? So I was in a class at school. I think I was in an art class, and, like, everyone was just talking about it. Even, like, the, you know, not people that were into bands, you know, like, just the regular, like, you know, people weren't into anything specific. Like, I heard people talking about it. Everyone was just talking about it. And when, you know, they were saying what had happened, obviously, like, when you know, especially when you're quite young and naive, it just sounded like, you know, it was so shocking and so dark that everyone was talking about it for a long time afterwards, you know.
It was very different from the Bowie thing, because, like, Kurt was, like, you know, he was a young guy, and he felt not to be too romantic about it, but he felt like one of us, you know, like these misfits and stuff, like these like loser kids in small towns. You just, like, Nirvana were, like, really important to those people, and, like, and at that age it was really hard, and it was really different from the Freddie Mercury thing too. Like, because Freddie Mercury died, like, only a few years prior, and that was dark because of, as I say, like, the sort of bullying that we took because of, like, the circumstances surrounding Freddie Mercury's death. But he was a superhero to you. He was like somebody on a different plane, It was something that you got into because you related to it, and they were important to you because you related to it. And, yeah, like, it's funny because, like, there's all these cliches about, like, how everything changed and all this stuff, but it really did change. Like, our teenage years went from being, like, you know, somewhat innocent to just being quite dark. Like, I think our teenage years went, like, on a different path after that. I mean, we formed a band, like, straight away. That it's just kind of like your duty. You have to form a band.
It's the only thing that you can think of to do. I don't know, like, you know, it's like such a flawed, weird way of thinking, but it's just like a knee-jerk response. Everyone's like, yeah, we'll do a band then, you know. That was some people's response. Some people at our school, big Nirvana fans, I remember shaving the hair off and never listening to music again. You know what I mean?
Oh my God.
At least pledging to never listen to music again.
No, but they didn't, though, because what they did is they started going uptown. They became like townies. They're into, you know, regular music after that, like dance music and stuff. It was weird.
Our first proper band, like, with a couple of schoolmates, called Wrinkle, and we practiced at, like, like a, you know, your classic sort of place called Audio Zone in Wakefield. It's on the Leather Jacket Love Song video, actually. There's footage of us practicing there around that time. And, like, you know, you just see classic thing, like, your friends would come hang out, because it's like, you know, you rent this place for £5 an hour, and it's a place where you can hang out and do whatever you want without your parents being around. So all your friends would come down and hang out, and every practice would be kind of like a bit of a party in that way. And, yeah, that stuff started to get dark from there, really, because, like, you've got your own space, and you know, that's where a lot of that hedonism starts. That, like, 14 years old, you, like, every weekend you've got, like, a few hours where you rent a room, essentially. That's weird. There's no other reason that you would allow your kids to do that, you know, like, a boom away from like their jurisdiction every weekend. But like, it would just be that started, but that was really fun, and it was really communal, and it really meant a lot to all those like punk kids in Wakefield to have places like that they could go.
Yeah, and you started meeting other people who were from so we were from Wakefield, we were from a park called, we went to school in a place called Harbury. There's all sorts of these little towns, and then you'd find out about a band over in Ossie, which is the next town over, or a band from out in Featherstone, or whatever, like all these tiny little enclaves around Wakefield. And it's just from going to band practice and rehearsing, yeah, you'd find out that there was other people doing that stuff. You had no idea that there was other people your age that were doing it. And
your friend group expanded like
the world opened up a little bit.
But then that also the parameters open up, because like, you know, you might meet a band who's like a few years older than you, and like they're smoking pot, or they're like, you know, doing whatever, and then you're exposed to that, and like it was rite of passage, really, and it wouldn't have happened in the same way had we not started a band, I don't think, you know. And but in a lot of ways, it's still some of the most romantic times of my life. There's something like that will never come back about that, like this idea of like feeling like that there's not many people who feel like you in your town, and then through music and through having a shared purpose, like you meet all these other people and realize that you do have a separate community, and like and then putting gigs on, like there's a bar in town called Players, which was like, it's legendary in Wakefield, but Players was like the Wakefield CBGBs. But the thing was, you could get in there when you were underage. And so we were like, we started our first ever gigs at Players at, like in 96 when we were like 15 or 16. And that's where we started playing our own shows, our first shows. And that was the sort of focal point of our lives up until starting the Cribs, really, I think, was Players. It was most important.
That's the thing that I think, like, you know, as much as obviously there's so many kind of positives to, you know, the way that the internet has sort of like made you realize that you're not just like one little island and the only person that thinks these things and likes these things, like there's something quite sad, I think, about like that sort of magic of it feeling properly tribal and properly like, you know, you have your little like scene or group of people, and that you're the only like six people in your entire town that listen to this band and they feel like yours. And I feel like that's something that feels like it's got, I don't know, I don't really know whether people kind of get that same feeling now, that you kind of know exactly the number of people that listen to that band because it says so on their Spotify profile. And
it made it kind of life or death, because it was a lifestyle to embark upon. You know what I mean? It wasn't something that it wasn't just like a style of music that you preferred. It was like you committed to this entire going to rehearse and putting shows on and meeting people. It took up so much of your time. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're going to get spat on or beat up every time you get on the bus with a guitar, or called a freak because you're wearing ripped jeans in town, like if that stuff's going to happen to you, you have to really love and be dedicated to that, that not just that music, but that culture. And it's what makes you hardcore in a lot of ways. It's like, I think, you know, the Cribs always had a reputation for being like, yeah, live or die and like hardcore and all this stuff. But it's like, it is forged in those sort of situations. It's like, if we'd have ever been casual with our relationship with music, we would have never got out of Wakefield, or we would have never even played any of those shows, because it was a pain in the ass to put those shows on. Like, it was like, and like, you'd be like 30 people would show up, and they'd all be amazed. But it was worth it, because you had to do that to validate those people who were there. You know, like that was worth it. I know a lot of people who were like really great musicians and really great bands, like so talented, but they just got demoralized because you know, you really did have to like live it like 100% of the time. And I think, like, you know, I understand why people fell by the wayside, but like that it did breed like a really hardcore, like dedicated bloody mindedness, really.
Have you heard of that book, This Is Memorial Device, by David Keenan? It's about this sort of stuff. It's on White Rabbit Books. It's this kind of thing that you've been talking about in Airdrie, like west of Glasgow. But it's an amazing book.
It's interesting to me because a lot of people, like, you know, commentators on a lot of this stuff like to like sort of make out as if things are better now. There's been a democratization and that it's better that it's not tribal, and it's better that everyone's like open to everything and everything's melded together. And it's like, look, there is something to be said for that, but I believe that like that there's something really, really special about music being being something way more to you than just something to occupy your mind or casually engage with. It's like that tribalism is like some of the most powerful experiences and meaningful experiences in my life came out of that, you know, because you fully trusted and believed in those people who felt the same way as you. And like, you know, I remember like you got to the Reading Festival, for example, the first time we went in 1997, and it was just all those kids from all those towns in one place. Mm-hmm. And it was like,
yeah,
extremely harmonious and beautiful, because you were just like, everyone was walking around like, nobody's like beating us up or throwing shit at us or like, or telling us to get a haircut. Like, and
it was like a full,
like you would walk past people's campfires and they were just like, like, it was really, I know it sounds like proper, like overly romanticizing, but like people would just invite each other around and like share everything with each other because like there was no boundaries. It was really, really like the first time everyone felt like they'd found their, like a safe environment like that. It was really great.
Yeah, I guess it's just sort of like, you know, that sort of calcifying your worldview, isn't it? Like when these things are more than just like, you know, pressing play on a playlist and kind of idly skipping through. Like even, you know, we've spoken a lot on this podcast about kind of the commitment that you had to have, like when you only had a tenner to buy one CD a week. So you had to like give it a go and listen to it loads and like really get into it and give it your time and your like energy in like a way more sort of like active and conscious way than I think really happens now when the choice, you know, you just get bored and flick things through and maybe won't ever go back to that album if it doesn't hit you immediately within like 20 seconds.
Well, me and I've got a few examples of that. Like, so for example, when Pinkerton, the Weezer record, came out in 96, it got bad reviews. And like, and we were on the show, we were like, the reviews were just like, so like mediocre or poor on that record that we had to like, as I say, like starve for a week to get a CD. So we were like, look, are we still going to buy this record? Because like, it's not supposed to be very good. But Rye was like, no, we need to do it. So we didn't, you know, so we went ahead and bought Pinkerton that weekend. And like now I can't listen to that record without, it's just 90, that is just 96. Like I put it on and it takes me right back to being in 1996. And nowadays, that wouldn't have, it just wouldn't have happened because like.
And I also remember having like, you know, around that time, after listening to it a bunch, starting to tell people it's better than their first album. And everyone was disagreeing with me like, nah, I'm just not into it. You know, it doesn't have it's not as good. It was something that you'd live with something, and it would soundtrack a period of your life, you know, even just a small period of it. It's almost like that's what some records are designed for. That some of them, that's what it's for. You know, mm-hmm. What I mean, it's not just for for a playlist or whatever. It doesn't work necessarily in that environment.
Yeah, and I think that's like, you know, something that was defining for us. It's like you had to live with the record, and like, you know, it became more meaningful the longer you listen to it. And it's like, yeah, I can still put Pinkerton on now, and it's like it makes me feel 15 again. I can't say that that's happened to me in the last 10 years, that I've got a record that puts me back in a certain place. Like, you know what I mean? It doesn't put me back in it. And sometimes it might. There might be a song and be like, oh, this really reminds me of like last summer or like, or whatever. But there's also like many other songs that remind me of that. So it's diluted, you know?
You spoke about, so Wrinkle was the first ever band, but the object that you brought in was Black Rats. So that is, tell us the story of Black Rats.
Well, right. It started off as Rocksteady and the Biker Boys, I think. and that was,
great name.
That was a band that wore bin liners as leather jackets and used to record behind my mum's sofa. That's the real shit, though, you know what I mean? So,
so I'll give you a little bit. They took me to a disco way out in San Francisco to hear some real cool rock and roll. Rock and roll. That's Rocksteady and the Biker Boys. It's weird how it's like kind of like 50s music, but like...
might be recording that. That was recorded at some point, but...
Yeah, that was the first thing. That was just me and Rye like recording behind the couch. But yeah,
how were you recording it? What were you recording it onto? Like,
it was like a little... It was a little cassette player that had, it was about that big, and it had a handle and a speaker built in. And that's why we listened to everything, though. For years, that's where all the Queen tapes we had, we listened to it on that. It was just a little cassette deck. I guess it was more the kind of thing that you plug a microphone into and record an interview, you know, back in the day.
We listened to the Bee Gees album on that as well, believe it or not. You know,
that's what we had for ages.
A speaker and a cassette input on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was repurposed, because that was used for the Spectrum computer that we had to play computer games. You used to load them from cassette, and that was the cassette deck for the Spectrum, but we repurposed it just for listening to music. Nice. So it was recorded on that, and then Black Rats was 91, and again, it was very much because of you know, the whole obsession with Queen, really. The Black Rats was like the Queen thing, like, you know, started to crest for us around 91. And so that's when we decided we wanted to make music again. And
What it was my uncle was the person who turned us on to Queen. And it was the summer holidays from junior school. It was still a junior school at the time. And it was summer holidays, and we were at my auntie and my uncle's house, because I think they were babysitting us because my mum and dad were at work. And so we were talking to him about Queen. We said, oh, we want to have a band. We want to have a band. And my auntie had just got a new, and she'd got a keyboard that had like loads of different sounds on it. And they'd got a karaoke machine that year as well, because they liked doing karaoke. But you realise that if you plugged the microphone into the tape deck, you could record your voice and you could put reverb on it and stuff, and then you could plug the keyboard into the as well. And so it was just something like it was really just something to do while we were being babysat, and we were obsessed with bands and music. It was like, oh, we'll just set this up and make some music. It's all atrocious, of course, but.
Did you think of it like, this is our first band? Like, did you have the mentality of like, we're making a band now, this is some songs we're writing for the band needs a name, etc., etc.?
It's more like the year before, we'd like, you know, we'd been like making home movies on a camcorder, so that, you know, it was just like something to do, you know. It's like but we, you know, it was really prolific, obviously, because it's like, you know, you just doing stuff every day, like, and some stuff would just be like, the so the the main thing was, like, it's like some of the stuff would, it was largely like improvising to like demos on the keyboard. So we'd like do improvisational stuff on that. And then some of it was like writing lyrics to video game music. So we'd like play the video game music and we'd write lyrics and sing melodies over the top. And then some of
it's
it was
ahead of the time.
Yeah, and then some of it was kind of like rap influenced, like, you know, very like, you know, just like saying how cool you were and like how tough you were, like that kind of thing. But to like rap beats. And then like some of it like was like live. We tried some stuff where it was this full live band. And that was that was like, that was almost like the Shags or something, like completely in that, but like almost like, no disrespect, like what I mean is, it's like we didn't really know what we were doing, but we had spirit. And then we would also be like messing about with the speed control and the cassette thing. So it was actually, it was like quite experimental in that way. You're a kid and you just like, you realize like, oh, I can change the speed and it makes me sound slower, it makes me sound faster. Like some of the live stuff that we recorded was like speed controlled and sounded really weird. And like
some of it was spoken word as well, don't forget. Like
it was quite a lot of spoken.
All of that, because I guess it's quite easy then to sort of go like, oh, okay, that's where you sort of learn to try things out. And, you know, the things that then when you started doing stuff as a proper band, you could be like, oh, okay, I've weirdly have done this before. Like I've kind of tried recording myself. I've tried experimenting stuff. It feels like, you know, a little bit familiar. But like, I think there's so much to be said for just like, we never really, you know, like I always imagine bands starting because like people were sat saying that they wanted to do a band together, or, you know, they each realized that they played instruments that combined in a certain way or whatever like that. Whereas there's something really to be said for just like, it was just something to do at the time. Like we just had a lot of hours to fill and that was a thing that was in front of us. Yeah.
And it was just kind of like pastime stuff, and it's almost like that kind of gets stuck in you, almost like, you know, that it just becomes something that you do. Because it's like, I think that when we were doing Black Rats, there was just like, yeah, long swathes of time in the summer holidays where there was just nothing happening. So, yeah, like Gary was saying, sometimes we film movies on a video camera, you know, and trying to make it an actual movie with a plot and stuff. And then when we were doing these recordings, we were really into like making artwork for it, or like you know, like, yeah, coming up with sleeve designs and stuff, because we you knew that that was just a part of it, you know. So we were kind of into all the like all the extra stuff that goes along with it, as opposed to the work of doing, of writing some songs, you know what I mean? Like, well, we'll just record anything, but then we'll make a really nice looking sleeve, or, you know.
The songs were like no bigger a part of it than like what the overall concept was, of like saying that we're Black Rats and like designing Black Rat sleeves. And like, you know, like Valentine's Day special, like that's one of the tapes, for example. That's because it was Valentine's Day, and we'd read the term Valentine's Day special. I think it was like a you know, a menu item, a Valentine's Day special. We're like, oh well, we need to make an album Valentine's Day special. So we, like, you know, that was, we had the album title, and we knew that the cover was gonna have a love heart on it, and so like we had to write some songs for it then. And like, so we just chose the like weediest and most romantic sounding demos on the keyboard and wrote some songs around them. And so the music was, I wouldn't say it was an afterthought, but it was just one element of what we were doing. Like, but there wasn't really any lessons learned. Like we didn't take any of it forward. The only thing that like I would say is like, the interest in recording was there, as in like, as I said, we realized you could mess around with the speed control and do like cool stuff with that, or like add reverb on the karaoke mics. That we were interested in the recording side of it. And like there's a record, there's one of the tapes is called Black Rats Live, which is not a live album, like suffice to say, we never played live. But we wanted to make a live album, like Queen, Live Killers, or Rare Live, or whatever. And so we conceptualized it as in, like, it was like, looking back, it was actually pretty clever what we did. We had two tape decks, and one tape deck we had playing Queen, Live Killers to get the audio of a large crowd, and then we would play the Black Rats cassette from a distance, so it sounded like it was coming from a distance. And then
followed that. Ingenious.
We also learned, but we couldn't, because we couldn't use the Queen cassette the whole way through it, because obviously they were going to start playing there.
So Freddie start talking and stuff like that.
So we realized that we needed to have crowd in between the songs, and we had a wrestling video game on the Nintendo. So we put that on the TV, and on the wrestling video game, every time your character climbs up the ropes, the crowd swells and cheers. So we could make the crowd swell and cheer at certain times. Now, it's kind of janky and stuff, but like, I like looking back, I'm impressed that like what we managed to achieve as like 11-year-olds, like conceptualizing how to do it. Like, it's like it required quite a lot of like messing around with different cassette decks and like
trial and error. Yeah, a lot of trial and error. But apart from that, when it comes to the music itself, I'd say as much effort went into turning a bin liner into a leather jacket as did writing the songs, you know what I mean? So
I mean, the bin liner leather jacket look is a very strong, if you've got a look that strong, who needs good Bad songs way. Anyway?
Bad
yeah. Okay. There are many things that I wish to ask about Black Rats. First one is, I mean, when you found these tapes, when you were looking through to bring stuff on here, like, did you go back and have a listen? Like, did the sort of like,
yeah,
are there good tunes nestled among these?
Digitized and archived them actually while I was at
nice.
It. But it's exactly the thing why I chose, the reason why we chose them is because like they've been with us our entire life. I've always known where those cassettes are, no matter how irrelevant they are. They've always been something that we knew where they were, except Rex the Wonder Dog. The cassette was missing from that for a while, but they've always been pretty close by. And the music, well, I say music, the content of the tapes was exactly as I remembered it. Like, it's...
Yeah.
It's singing along to video games and stuff like that, really.
What would you be writing about? Like, can you remember what the... Like,
yeah, universal themes. We are the one, we are the sun. That's one of the songs. That's kind of like a We Are the World kind of band.
Well, he did have a Way Out of the World fight, but Ross recorded one thing on his own in his bedroom, which we didn't even know about. But when I listened to the tape, it was actually the most impressive thing. Super avant-garde. It was called How My Body Works, and it was really avant-garde. Spoken word, a lot of tape slowing down. We didn't even really realise that he'd done it. He must have been like 7 or 8 at the time. But that was the best stuff. It's really out there.
It wasn't spoken word. It was a cappella, really. It was more a cappella.
A lot of primal screaming, a lot of like tape slowing down. Like, it's weird, is that song. Even by today's standards, that is proper weird stuff.
There was
when it goes to my mum telling him, it immediately dovetails out of that. Somehow he's spliced in my mum like shouting at us, like really annoyed about something. It's so weird.
There was a song called Rex the Wonder Dog. Is just that's just a peon. Like, my cousin had finally got a puppy, like, and we'd wanted a puppy forever. So that was just a. It seemed like the ideal thing to write about.
Perfect.
Lionizing him.
We are the sun. What else was the
rat song, obviously.
Oh, no. High on the Heart or whatever. What is it?
Higher Than the Heart.
Higher Than the Heart.
That was the rat song, like a theme tune.
Yeah,
it was, yeah.
Goes, dirty rat, silly prat, what you think you're looking at? That's the rat.
Surprised that you can remember.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's like, it's been with me like forever. Like, it's like those the reason why I brought them in is because it's like they're items that I've had in my since 92 that I've always known where they are. For whatever reason, I've always known where they are. And I mean, it's terrible. Like it's I can't recommend anything that's on the cassettes really, but it's
how my body works. I mean, how my body works is that's a gem, man. It's impressive, is that one. But
next album, maybe you could resurrect it, give it a 2024 reboot.
Yeah, maybe.
Oh, we're not going to beat that one.
Bonus track, like those hidden ones that you always used to get, like if you left the tape running for like an extra couple of minutes at the end, and then it just kicked back in if you were patient enough.
Yeah. Or if you pressed rewind on the first track, did you have any CDs that did that?
Yeah, Ross had one of those. When he found out that his CD did that, I can't remember how he found out, but he always wanted, when we did the cribs, whenever we would go to mastering, he always wanted to do one like that. He was always like, oh, we should have something that, like, when you rewind it, it's at the beginning. A lot of mastering houses didn't know how to encode that, so we never did it. But he was always interested in that concept. I mean, it is a good concept, you know. If it, rather than putting it at the end after a long gap, it's a lot better hidden in the negative numbers.
But it is actually a complex thing because we've spoke to loads of mastering places and because Ross always wants to bring it up, and. But none of them have known how to do it, so it must be still be quite pioneering.
I feel like I read about someone doing it again recently. Now I think it's probably more well known now, but I don't know.
Was the Cribs the next band after Black Rats finished, or were there interim projects?
Well, I mean, there was Wrinkle obviously, and then Ross had a band, Rat Monkey, that were like very pop punk. That was in like the late 90s. Like they were good actually. Like Rat Monkey were good, and I think that was it. Like I was in a couple of like various bands too, like Riot Girl stuff. Ryan had the Jesus Killing Machine.
Yeah, that was a black metal band, but found a tape of that actually as well. That is well epic.
We should mention the Jesus Killing Machine. It was Ryan and my friend, the cellist that we said that we used to play in the orchestra with us and get stoned. So it was Ryan and this guy Rob Smith who played cello.
That was 90s black. Like I was in a black metal band in the 90s. You know, that's true cult. Is that that's what you that's versus true cult, I believe.
Well, I would personally quite like you to do some sort of collective archive thing with like all of these bands of your youth in one place. Collect fans collector's edition.
It's all archived. It's like we're just, you know, just trying to figure out the best way to release it. Like, but yeah, it's all just sat there waiting.
There we go. What would be a true way for the 90s? Like you've just got to like hand do the cassettes yourself and like.
Yeah, we used to do that. That was a massive. It was a massive job. It was like we used to get like 50 cassettes dubbed at a time, like make labels on the home computer and stuff like that. Which was like that was the hard bit, getting the printer to print the labels, and then then the other hard bit was having 50 cassettes under your bed that nobody remotely cared about, but
it's a simpler time.
It was a big outlay of money for us to get cassettes duplicated, but also the
printer cartridge costs was the most expensive part about it, though. Like getting color printer cartridges and trying to print all the stuff, and then you have to cut them all out with a scalpel. And yeah, I think you pretty much knew that they were basically just going to live under your bed, like Gary was saying. So.
But it was still worth it, you know. It was, again, it's just those formative influences. Like it just mattered to like do it and have it, you know.
You made it real, having something in your hands that you've made.
That's it.
Graduating from 50 cassettes in your bed to an entire crate of Pepsi Crystal, whatever it's called, in your basement. In some ways, it was same as it ever was. okay, I think that is great. What a great, Yeah, I really, really would love to hear how my body works. It sounds like a lost gem.
Proper weird. I
had no idea that Ross was like the beef art of the group, but
I think I'd forgotten about that. I think I'd forgotten that he was as well, to be honest.
That was Ryan and Gary Jarman of The Cribs, Wakefield legends, indie legends, now 8 albums into their tenure, I believe looking towards their 9th. More to come on that. And just generally good. I feel like The Cribs are good at like stoking the lore around their band. They understand that like to really love a band is to want to get into the sort of the mythology around the early days, all of the little pieces of the puzzle that you put together, be that influences, be that kind of mad little stories from the past. And they are really brilliant at just creating that for Cribs heads around the world, of which I class myself a big one. So thank you so much, Gary and Ryan, for joining us. Thank you for listening, as ever. If you want to keep listening to this podcast, there are a whole bunch of episodes from season one. We are cracking on with season two. You can give us a like and a subscribe and you will get the pod into your podcast inbox on a Tuesday morning. You can leave us a review, which we'd really love, as long as it's nice. They are very helpful to us continuing to spread the good word. And also, while you're at it, why not check out the new issue of DIY magazine proper? That is with Bob Villain. Two excellent other punks. You know what? I feel like The Cribs would be Bob fans. Mm-hmm. I feel like they are coming from the same sort of DIY cloth. DIY in the sense not just of a magazine, although we love putting both in our magazine. But so if you pick up the April edition, you will get a cover feature with Bob Villain. You will get other chats with the likes of St. Vincent, Lizzie McAlpine, Girl in Red, all sorts of other people. So give that a read. You can subscribe to the magazine, you can subscribe to us, and we will see you next week for the next episode of Before They Knew Better with DIY Magazine.